Serka ile önemli bir yaz çalışması geçirdik. Şimdi küçük bir görüşme yapacağız onunla. Thank you very much for the wonderful workshop. And I would like to talk with you about the future of psychodrama. And also I would like to have a suggestion to psychodramatists in Turkey and in all over the world.
Yes, well, I enjoyed the workshop too. People were wonderful. Can I look at you a little bit? I have some ideas about how I think we could maximize the use of psychodrama in the world to take it out of the clinical setting and into the community at large so that we help people out there to improve their lives. And so I've been thinking very seriously. We have such a terrible problem in marriages and family. It appears that people do not make good choices for mates. And so a very large, almost half of all marriages end in divorce. And that seems to be increasing rather than decreasing. So one of the ideas that we conceived some years ago already was that we should have a premarital clinic for young people to come, or anyone who's considering joining his or her life with a mate, to come and test it out before they go ahead and do it, and especially before they go ahead and have children. And our idea was that you can test each partner separately while the other watches. On what their expectation, first of all, what they're going to be in future, if there is a future, what their expectations are of themselves, but also of their mates. For instance, we have found that young people, some young people, they know that first, the young woman is going to get married to a man who's going to be a teacher. And she also knows that eventually when the children come, she won't be able to work. She's a secretary or a nurse or a teacher or a professor even. Well, then she proceeds to project upon the stage what she thinks her home will be like. Now we know that they will have limited income, and they will be middle class, but not really upper middle class. And she projects upon the stage a mansion, a palace. It's her expectation. It happens. Meanwhile, the young man is sitting there watching, getting very unhappy, because he knows he is going to fail her. And then when you fail someone, there's bitterness and recriminations and disappointment. Then often also they may have discussed this, a difference in religion. And still, when you put them in a future projection, very often it comes out that, let's say the woman is Catholic and the husband is Protestant, as we have in the West. And he is quite agreeable that the children be brought up as Catholic. So we project a Sunday morning going to church, to Mass. How many children does she have? Well, 4 or 5 children. She gets the children ready to go to Mass. And then one of the children, one of the auxiliary egos, very smartly in this test said, "Is Daddy coming to Mass too, or to church?" And inadvertently, she didn't realize what she was saying, but she said it. She said, "Not now, but he's going to come to the church later." Now, obviously, although they've discussed it for months, her expectations are, yes, he will be of the same religion that she is, even though we've made it quite clear that he's not going to change his religion. So what happens is that when these future expectations are not realized, there's bitterness and a great deal of trouble. So it is important that young people work these things out before they get engaged and get married, or have children, or live together. Because these days a lot of young people live together, don't get married, but still have children. It's like a family without the law. So we test them on the level of the intimate relationship and the work relationship and any community contact. For instance, Do they belong to an organization or a church? Or do they do volunteer work? Or do they have a hobby? Do they play sports? Do they go hiking? Do they do any of this together or not? Very often, if they don't do it together, it means that he has his own friends and she has her friends. That pulls them away from each other. They can't share this with each other. It's obvious that the more interactions young people have mutually, in which they mutually connect, the more stable is the marriage, especially in terms of the more central relationships, the central roles. For instance, sexual companion, physical companion. That does not mean sexual, that's just how they use space around themselves.
What do you mean by that?
Well, she needs a lot of space and he needs a lot of space. There's not going to be enough space in a small house for two people who need a lot of space. They invade each other.
Like a rumblefish.
Yeah,
do you
like
know
what?
This? Rumblefish.
Right. So, or she needs very little space and he needs a lot, but eventually he eats up her space too. See that happening? So, that's space, physical companion. Can they stand being close with each other without being sexual? For instance, do they eat together? Do they cook together? Do they go out together? That's what I mean by physical companion. Intellectual companion. Do they have things in common in which they can relate? I mean, if he's full of sports and she's interested in psychology, are they going to get together in terms of intellectual mutual interests or not? Does it mean he has to give up his sports and learn something about psychology, or is she going to give up her psychology and move into sports? That's usually what happens. A woman gives up her interest and moves into that of her mate. So, but eventually she may resent that. Then the other things that happen. When a child is born, a child is a total revolution in a marriage. So the role of the parent, the expectations of the role of the parent, how the two interact. Does he leave all the responsibility for rearing the children to her? There are many cultures in which the husband's role has nothing to do with the children. It's all mother's job. That doesn't work anymore today. And we have to have balance there. How ready is he to assume his responsibility as a father? What we see in our work, one of the most interesting things we see in our work, is these absent fathers. They are physically there, but emotionally they have no contact with these children, or very superficial. So expectations of how parents will interact with children in the future, these all color the relationship that these two young people have. And so it is very important that before they make these important decisions, they feel their way out. Have they made the right decision? Is this really the right partner? Not just for now. They may be very enthusiastic about each other now. What about the future? What about 10 years from now? So we have, in fact, in doing this, broken up some very great, beautiful romances. And then the friends used to come and say, how can you do this? It was such a beautiful relationship, such a beautiful romance. And Moreno would say, that's the problem. It was a romance. It was not real life. Life is not a romance. It's nice to be romantic in life, but there are certain realities which overbear all that. And if the realities are not mutually realizable, a couple is in trouble. Mm-hmm. So, role testing for marriage prediction. So premarital clinics. I think we need that for the young people. Once they decide, yes, this is the partner I want. Now, I'm assuming that they both decide they want children. If they both don't want children, it's no problem. Assuming that they maintain a good relationship. What if one wants children and the other one doesn't?
Yeah.
Happens. I have a nephew whose wife didn't want children. They lived next door to a couple with whom they were friends. The husband didn't want children. They two got together, they were divorced. My nephew married his neighbor's wife. after she divorced. And they had two children. I don't know what happened to the others. But what I'm not saying that the couples interchanged, I'm not saying that. But it was such a motivating force to be a parent that he couldn't endure staying in that marriage. And I've known other young people who, for the same reason, have left a marriage, although they got along well. But the future wasn't rich enough for them, the expectation of the future. So then we come to parenthood. What stuff are they bringing into their relationship with their wives and husbands as parents from their own family? Because most of us have not had very good models of how marriages work. So sooner or later, what we've learned from our parents, we may do in our marriage even though we don't want to. You know, we think we can avoid it, but you can't. So it isn't only that they need to work on the marriage connection. They need to work on all that old stuff and get rid of it, to cleanse themselves of all that stuff. I told you the story about the wife who's pregnant and that she has to produce a boy or else.
Yes.
I mean, it's a terrible thing to do. So what expectations of gender? Does she want only girls because boys are dirty? And she gets a boy, that she's going to destroy, she's going to have an abortion each time she carries a boy. I mean, now we can see that. We can make images of that. Are his expectations only of boys or of girls or hers? So that's another future expectation as parents. What influences are there still from the parents on his parents and her parents on both sides that influence and may distort their parental relationship? For instance, grandmother wants to be with them all the time to take care of the baby, but the parents don't really want her because she's too strict with the child and they have modern ideas of rearing a child. See, in other words, all these things have to be brought into consideration to start thinking sociometrically. Who else is connected to this young couple, but who may influence the couple? Remember the time when you came home with a girlfriend and your parents didn't like her?
Yes.
Or you have a girlfriend and her parents don't like you? That influences our choices, even though we don't want to. It influences, it colors them.
Exactly.
And it affects our expectation. Many young people get married just to get away from mama and papa. It's the worst reason for getting married. Much better they work out their relationship with mama and papa before they get married. In any case, so that's another thing. So a clinic for parents, for young parents. I think we can do a lot of good in the culture. We can make the family more stable, more healthy, less dysfunctional by training people. We don't have models for this.
Yes.
And every generation is different because now we have these technological advances that our parents didn't have in their life. I mean, we have cell phones, we have television, we have technology, we have computers. They're not going to go away. And they influence how we rear our children. How much time should a child be sitting in front of the computer or in front of the television set, for instance? Is this healthy for them? Is this good for their development? How can the family get together and do things together again? Go on a picnic or on holiday or something, or an outing together. So it's a matter of re-educating the young people very often. I want to see a psychodrama 24-hour emergency clinic in every neighborhood where people can come, just like they go to the emergency room in the hospital, to work out their problems. Before violence, before rape, before murder.
Oh. Hello?
We should have a place where people can come to work out their problems currently, before they explode into violence or murder, or horrible stuff that happens in the family. Parents discover their child is using drugs. What are they going to do about it? Child threatens to commit suicide. The depressed mother, an alcoholic father. These are all... They have immediate needs.
Advice.
We may not be able to treat the whole thing, but at least take care of the immediate needs and then refer them to a proper agency to be taken care of. So, an emergency clinic. I want to see a psychodramatist in every hospital. Because I have undergone surgery and had some horrible experiences, not with my doctor, but with the nurses and with the ancillary staff. Now that should happen. Those things, for instance, I'll give you an example. I've had an amputation, and 9 months later I find a lump in my breast. Now it has no connection with the amputation, but it's on the same side. We don't know yet what it is. I go to the hospital again because the doctor wants to take it, to cut it out and do a frozen biopsy, section. Before I go to the hospital to the surgery, the nurses bind my legs because they find that that's, you know, good to take care of the pressure on the legs, whatever. It's a new thing. I don't think they do that anymore, but at that time they did it. They take all the precautions. They give me a shot to calm me down. They take me to the surgery, and I'm supposed to get a second shot. But I don't know about that, of course. Meanwhile, I've already got one shot, and I can't speak anymore, but I can hear everything. Mm-hmm. Two nurses, before I go to the surgery, two nurses start fighting over who should have given me the second shot. My supervisor. Now, I know exactly what a catatonic patient feels like. You can't speak, but you can hear everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm terrified, because I'm supposed to be going to sleep, but I don't dare go to sleep till I see my doctor, the one that I trust. So they wheel me into surgery, and I'm not awake, and asleep, I'm awake. And I stay wide awake. And I don't fall asleep until I hear, "Hello, Mrs. Moreno," and because I'm deaf, they turn my head, and I see my doctor standing in the frame of the door, and I go out like that, because I'm safe.
Yes.
That shouldn't happen. I think every nurse and every doctor should role reverse at least once with one of their patients and know what it's like. Be on a gurney and be knocked out. I mean, you can work yourself into, you know, hypnotize yourself into falling asleep, for instance. There are all kinds of things that we can do to improve patient care. Care for patients. So in every hospital. We need them in every school, every school system. Not just for the teachers and the students, for the principal and the teachers, for the parents and the teachers, for the parents and the children, mm-hmm. for the superintendent and the principal. And every hierarchy produces different set of problems. And very often the principal is very isolated. He doesn't have good contact with the rest of the staff. He doesn't know what's going on. My son came home from school, from high school, or intermediary school, I remember now, I was about 12 years old. And he said to me, "Mother, we, the students, we know exactly who prostitutes, who shoots, who sells." It means drugs. The faculty doesn't have a notion. We, the students, know. We could teach them what's going on. But they don't ask us, they don't look at us, they don't deal with us that way. That shouldn't happen. What happened in Columbine in Colorado, mm-hmm. that violence, these two boys were isolates. Nobody had any contact with them. So they got together. We have a saying in America, in English, rather, thick as thieves. Thieves will get together because they have a common goal. Yeah. The common goal is violence or murder or thievery or whatever. That shouldn't happen. As two kids. Nobody knows that they have guns and that they're planning this sort of thing. We should sociometrize the classroom and see who are the isolates and help them, integrate them into the class, mm-hmm. so that they can find balance then. Mm-hmm. They're imbalanced in their social life, which means in their socio-emotional life. They don't have healthy contact. Mm-hmm. They don't have healthy contact, they'll make unhealthy contact. I would like, it's probably never going to happen, but I would like to see sociologists and psychodramatists in Congress of the United States. I mean, what goes on there is unbelievable. We have these lobbies, people with a lot of money. They're buying these congressmen. They're giving them money, they're giving them trips, they're giving them privileges of all kinds. Is this representative government of the people, by the people, and for the people? It's nonsense. I mean, what's happening, for instance, now, I laugh at what's happening with Gore and Bush. I mean, the whole thing is it's a charade. No. We need a lot of changes in this world. And what psychodrama does best, painful though it is to reveal the truth. The truth about what's really going on that isn't dealt with or talked about on the news. That's where I think our greatest contribution is. On that level, in the community, we need social clubs where psychodrama is being done, where young people can come and meet instead of hanging out on the streets. And they come and work out their problems. And good, healthy guidance to learn something about what life is about. And life in the next, century perhaps, is not getting easier. On some level, these machines are making life easier. On some levels, they're making it more complicated. Mm-hmm. For instance, these machines we have, there are people who don't relate to other people except through the machine. Is this healthy? I mean, it's another very severe form of isolation. They make communication easier. So what do you have? You can communicate violence too that way, pornography, everything. I mean, the machine is neutral, it's how you use it that's the important thing, the way to use it. So I think we have a really tremendous task ahead of us to make life worthier, to make the human being worthier, to make life worthier of the human being, both ways. And I think this is where we have a true calling. I wish I were younger so I could start some of these things up again. Can't do it, but I can at least inspire other people to do it. People like you and Nisha and others. Yeah, I think we are needed. Very much needed. And we need to be well educated, not only in psychology or psychodrama, but as humanists, to understand about art and music and literature and the sciences, even. We need to develop rounded, well-rounded people. Not just in psychology, I think that's not enough. My husband encouraged people to go to theater, to read books, to travel, to grow, to become wider and deeper in book, to learn about life. Not just clinically, but what it's all about out there. And that is happening. More people are traveling, and there is more interchange interculturally. That also means that our cultures are in fact changing. Because everyone here is becoming Americanized, for instance. I don't know why everybody wants to be American. I mean, it's nonsense. They're beautiful old cultures that we should respect, that have a lot to teach us. For instance, old China versus the new. I don't see that the new China has as much to teach us as the old China. Or sections of India, for instance, that have a cultural inheritance of wisdom that we don't want to lose. But if the world goes on like this, we're all going to be mass involved in a global village without any distinction. I think that's a pity. Those are some of my thoughts, and I think it's important to encourage young people to broaden their scope, to work in groups.
Yeah. So in such a word, the term, the concept tele is so important.
Right.
And it is the most difficult concept that can...
people to understand.
Yes.
It is complicated. It's not as complicated though as they make it. Now tell you what makes it complicated. We are role players. And our interaction with other people involves roles. And that's where the tele is significant. But let me explain it a bit.
Can we?
About tele. Moreno taught us that there was first the word empathy was used in German psychology at the beginning of the last century. Mm-hmm. Empathy at that time was described as a person feeling themselves into an object. It's not person to person yet. It was, for instance, if you're standing in front of a big, tall sculpture, you feel yourself stretching into it. You're not asking the sculpture to feel with you. You're feeling it, or in a painting. If you're in the looking at this painting, and you're projecting yourself into it. Mm-hmm. That was called empathy. Later on, it began to be used for people. I empathize with you. You're telling me a story, and I empathize with you. Well, that's one way, and it's projectional. I project my empathy upon you. You may not have asked me. You may just want to tell me a story. Okay. Then came Freud, and he described in great detail transference. Transference is that the psychoanalyst is to be a blank screen. The patient projects upon this this blank screen feelings and experiences and so on, and in the course of therapy develops a relationship to this person which is may not be realistic. It may involve the idea of an ideal uncle, an uncle they loved, or a grandparent, and then begin to relate to that analyst as if that person is the uncle or the grandparent, when in fact he's not, just a blank screen. Well, that's also projectional, and it's one way, patient to therapist. Now, in the course of contact over time between therapist and patient, Freud describes counter-transference. Counter-transference is what the therapist projects upon the patient. For instance, here's this beautiful young woman. She reminds him of the first girl he was in love with. Now, he's also human. And he may have all kinds of ideas about her, although he doesn't really want to. He wants to stay neutral, but it's difficult. Moreno says there is no such thing as counter-transference. It isn't counter, for the simple reason it isn't real. What is happening is you have a parallel process going on. Patient to therapist, therapist to patient. So you have a parallelogram of feelings. Where mathematically does a parallelogram meet? Do you remember that, your mathematics?
I don't know.
In infinity.
Yes.
Which means that it takes a long time to resolve this. Now, Freud made it very clear that this is a neurosis on the part of the patient. I assume he also thinks that it's a neurosis on the part of the therapist, but he doesn't say that. It's always the patient who's neurotic, mm-hmm. right? Therapist is fine, he's been analyzed. He's clear. Nonsense, of course, it doesn't work that way. But anyway, now, what happens is that because one half of the relationship remains in the dark, it is extremely difficult for the patient to get through the transference and clear it away. If that patient were to say to the analyst, I'm having trouble with my daughter. I know you have a daughter. Do you have trouble with her? You know what the therapist would say? You are resisting the process. Stays out of it. Right? Or doesn't answer at all, which is even worse.
Well, so, why do you ask this question?
Yeah, why do you ask this? Yeah. So then we go again into another lot. So that makes transference very difficult to resolve. And the question is, how many psychoanalysts can really resolve a transference? We used to get lots of patients who've been in therapy with other therapists, other analysts, of different kind, and couldn't resolve it. And psychodramatically they could, but not in their therapy, in the original therapy. So, beside Moreno says it isn't counter. Put up your hand. This is encountering. Touching, connecting, feeling. So this, for Moreno, it's really a scientific myth or a misnomer to call it counter-transference. You have two transferences, only one of which is dealt with. The other one remains in the dark. Okay. That particular experience arises in a clinical setting of a very special kind.
Yes.
And Moreno said it is not a natural relationship. this is not how people relate outside the clinic. So what happens then outside? If transference, he says, for him, transference is dissociative. You cannot build a group on transference. It falls apart. So what bonds people? What cements people together? And he said there is something else going on between people. And he called it tele. Tele comes from the Greek. It means projection into space on television, telegraph. Now we have it all over the place. For Moreno, it is a unit of feeling projected from one feeling person upon another, but always considered in terms of mutuality. Are we in a mutual relationship or not? One-way relationships do not work. So what bonds people together is mutuality in a relationship, as business partners, as professional partners, as intellectual mates, as husband and wife, as lovers, whatever. So he says that if a relationship lasts throughout life, in spite of the difficulties, people fight it out, but they still stay together, as many as our marriages do, fortunately, then it is not transference. Because transference doesn't work, doesn't bond people, it separates people. That bond is called tele. And it is based upon several factors. A mutual recognition of the other person, even with their faults and failings. Is that? I know that this man I'm in love with is not perfect, but I love him anyway. I can see his faults and failings, but they're okay. I would rather spend my life with him than with anybody else. And he chooses me for the same reasons. I can be bitchy sometimes, but it's okay. He can get over it. Or he can make me sweet, or whatever. So what ties people together is tele. Now, it has been, I don't think anyone has ever researched transference. So here we have a difference. It is not one way, and it's not projectional. It's based on the reality. For instance, if I say to you, I think you're a warm person, you recognize yourself as a warm person, you say, yes, that's true. If I say to you, I think you're too critical, and you don't feel you're critical, you can correct me.
Yes.
And my tele for you will take the correction better than if it were transference. Mm-hmm. Now, that does not mean that tele is always found in pure form. Nothing in nature is found in pure form. Coal has to be mined. Gold has to be mined. It has to be cleansed of other substances. The problem arises when transference and tele get mixed up. I believe that many of our young marriages don't work because they're based on transference. What we want the other person to be, not what that other person really is. That's why we want the testing to be done before. What are your expectations and are they realistic? And do they fit this person and this relationship or not? So, tele has to be worked on, has to be cleansed. Do you know that even best of friends have fights? They either decide, I can't stand this person anymore, or they say, no, this person is so valuable to me, and I think I'm valuable to that person. Let's work it out. I'm sorry I had this argument with you. I didn't mean it that way. I used the wrong term. I meant to say, whatever. Cleansing it of the negative or even the positive transference. Reality-based. And it's very interesting about Taylor. When Taylor really works, people know it. They recognize there's a click that goes on. And it's bonded, it's very firm. For instance, I may never see you again, but we have had tele. Huh? And you know it, you can feel it. Okay. Now, I don't think anyone's ever researched transference. But Moreno did a very important study, which is included in Who Shall Survive, on tele. Mm. I'll tell you what it was. Has a long title, the original. It's called Sociometric Configurations Based on Deviation from Chance. Mm-hmm. Now, what did he do? This was in that school in Hudson, New York, where he worked with the girls. He went to one of the cottage mothers and said, could he do a sociometric study at the dining room table? These girls lived in, about 26 girls lived together with 28 girls, and they ate together. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, 3 times a day, at tables of 4. And she said, yes, she'd be interested in seeing that done. So What they did was, this was a test. They told the girls they were going to test them to see how they relate to one another. They didn't know the details yet. They decided to keep the door closed until all the girls were there, then open the doors, and this is chance, allowing the girls to go to the table they want. I think I described it. Maybe not in this book, but no, in another paper. Six girls go to one table. There's only room for four. Six girls rush over there. Another girl is alone over there. Two girls are over there. Five are in another corner. Three in another. What happens? Chaos. The next step is autocracy. The house mother says, come on girls, this doesn't work. You two over there, go over there. Now she reassigns them. That's not sociometry. That's chaos. In other words, laissez-faire doesn't work. It's called laissez-faire. Let them do, huh? Let them say. Doesn't work. Forget about that. Now, he got a mathematician to work out, based on deviation from chance, on chi-square, how often would girls choose each other mutually if they were given three choices?
Yes.
N minus one, the four, so you don't choose yourself. So they figured it out mathematically. Now the next thing is pulling names out of a hat. 28 girls, take one name out, choose three, record them, put that one back. So for everybody. And they mapped that thing mathematically. Now comes the sociometric choice. They allowed the girls to write down whom they wanted to sit next to at the dining room table. What they found was that on the basis of mutuality, it's especially mutuality of choice that makes Tele visible. Mm-hmm. If I choose you to play tennis, but you don't choose me to play tennis for obvious reasons, where's the Tele? Mm-hmm. It's not connecting. Now, the strength of a group depends on the number of mutual choices. And interestingly enough, stars, people who are chosen very often, are usually the people in small groups that have the largest number of mutual choices. That makes them stars. Very interesting. And not just because they have mutual choices, but because each of these people who chose them are chosen by other people. So their influence travels through this person to all the others, through this person to all the others. This one person may control through these two choices or three choices the emotional context of the entire group by virtue of mutuality. Very interesting. Okay, what did they find? The number of mutual choices, comparing it with the other chance configuration and pulling out of a hat, was 238% more frequent than in chance. And the chances of not being chosen was 38.5% greater by chance than in sociology. So, there it was. It was quite clearly proven. There is a factor which binds people together and we call it tele. Now, tele also, that's related to physical companion at the dining room table. There you talk about physical companion. Now, that doesn't mean the same person will be chosen for other roles, interactions.
Yes.
In fact, it's very often that we're chosen by different people for different role interactions. That's what people don't understand. They think that tele is an overall generalized pattern. It isn't. I may choose you to talk about psychodrama. I may choose somebody entirely different to go for a walk with.
Yes.
That has nothing to do with my relating to you this way. You may choose somebody else to go to theater with, you wouldn't go with me. I'm just saying. So people have to stop thinking of tele as being a generalized pattern, like a cream that you put on everybody's face. No, it doesn't work like that. It's very specific, and it's role-related, and interaction, role-interaction related. So that's what they have to learn to realize. Now, it is also true that we have, besides positive tele, negative tele, two people choosing, rejecting each other mutually. And then we have what we call incongruous tele. I choose you, but you don't choose me back. There's an incongruity. There's no relationship possible that way. That has to be studied very, very carefully. The problem is, there are several problems in this, in that in each group that we've studied, wherever, in every culture, a certain percentage of people are what we call isolated. And there are many levels of isolation. The most severe isolation is the person who does not choose and is not chosen, completely open. The second is chooses, but is not chosen. The third is chooses, but is rejected. The fourth is only rejecting other people. These are all levels of isolation. They have to be dealt with, because in every group we found 15%.
50.
1/6 of the youth of the world, that those are people who are not connected, not rooted, have no stable connection to anybody. That's dangerous.
Yeah.
They can form dangerous gangs, or they become violent, or they become mentally ill, or they become addicted, or whatever. So, besides the psychodramatic aspect, we have this sociometric aspect. And it works in families as well. We see parents who reject their children, or are more drawn to one child or another, neglect the others. That all has to be worked. So we, in our psychodramatic parenting situation, that kind of family therapy has to be integrated into our process. So sociometrizing the family. Did you read my blended family in one of Marcia's book? Psychodrama, Inspiration and Technique.
Yes.
It was fascinating how we worked with them, step by step by step. Mm-hmm. I met that father at an American Psychiatric Association meeting in Atlanta 10 years later.
Sir.
And he had become a psychiatrist. Remember, I described how he became, wanted to give up neurosurgery?
Yes.
Became a psychiatrist, family was doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. So, and what is involved is time and space. Who sits down at the dining room table together? And why is somebody missing? Sharing time and space.
Yes.
Those are dynamic categories for sociometry to operate within, for Taylor to be able to operate.
Yeah, these two concepts are so important.
Very important, yeah. And this business of the psyche being outside the body, this idea of radiating from the heart without, is part of the Taylor process. I find that Taylor is the corridor through which that travels through the psyche. Now, I remember when I went to Australia for the first time in 1976. On the plane, I thought, well, they had told me there will be 125 people. That was the largest group I'd worked with for a long time. There are surely going to be some people who are strangers to one another. How will that affect the choice process for auxiliary ego? Maybe 5-6 times out of 10, they will choose a stranger who will say, "It's amazing you picked me because," and out will come a parallel story. I was wrong. It was 9 times out of 10. A stranger was picked who said, "I have a very similar story."
Mm-hmm.
Now, that, I think, is something important for us to realize. We all have Taylor, and it's invisible.
Yes.
It's a knowing beyond knowing.
Yes.
It's very interesting. Well, this is one kind. We know. But up there are other people who we haven't met yet, and yet we know them in some way when we meet them. So knowing beyond knowing. It's invisible. Now, it's very interesting, for instance, in 1,000 people, one drug addict, and then we'll find another one. One alcoholic, we'll know another one. One criminal, we'll know another one. Well, you and I wouldn't know.
Yes.
I mean, they're not wearing horns, you know. So they're devils, and we can tell what they are. They know. They sense it. And patients have a very highly developed pathological sense.
Yes.
They know exactly which buttons to push in you. Because they don't have a healthy outlet for it.
Mm-hmm.
They're not anchored properly and rooted in life. So they don't have a healthy outlet. They find a pathological outlet.
Yes.
It's fascinating. It deviates. Yeah? Does that make it more understandable
yes.
and comprehensible?
Yes.
Yes. That requires a lot of study.
Yeah.
Sure. It's fascinating. For instance, show you how Taylor works. Something would happen during the day between us, and we wouldn't talk about it. And then at night, either I or Moreno would say, "Did you notice?" And he'd say, "Yes, I did." Or, "What do you think of a..." "That's just what I was thinking about." Or, "Oh, you're at a party with a friend and someone tells a story." And you look at each other as if to say, "Who's that guy?" And you know exactly what the other one is thinking. Huh? Wordless. Kitty is very often wordless, silent. Yes. But it's bonding just the same. Yeah. It has a capacity to tie people together. For instance, I had it very strongly with my last protagonist. She came to me. Nisha heard it. Well, maybe that's the truth. Let's eliminate that because that doesn't belong. Can you edit? You can edit.
Yeah, yeah.
But there were some people in the group with whom I had an immediate contact, and I could feel it, and they could feel it. They even told me that they felt it. Yeah. Not equally. It didn't stop me from working with them because I'm a professional.
Yes.
But there's something very special when the tailing works mutually, when it flows between two people. You can feel it. You feel well with that person. And you feel healthy, you feel integrated, you feel nourished, and you know you can nourish them. Now, Moreno wrote this book, Sociometry, Experimental Method, and the Science of Society, pacing up and down our living room. And I used to type very fast. I stopped taking notes because I discovered I could type it as fast as he spoke it, which saved a lot of time, obviously. Very energy and time saving. Because he would be walking back and forth, cogitating, thinking, I would get very nervous. I would learn to take knitting or sewing to do.
Yes.
And then the minute he started to speak, I'd drop it. I had my both arms then, both my arms. And I would start typing. Well, at a certain moment, I am typing a while after he stopped speaking, and I realized, so Moreno used to walk up and down, dictating, and because it made me tense to just sit there and do nothing and listen, I would knit or sew, embroider, and drop it when he began to speak.
Yes.
And then when he stopped, I'd pick it up again.